The Unperturbed Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Wednesday, and it's time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and alongside a team of people with staggering skills, co-host Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, media maven Nicole Rochelin, who's trapped at a school event tonight with her son, then I found out it's really a Rockets game. So, you know, wah-wah, call a ambulance, Nicole, right? And my very resourceful intern, Tatiana Gago, who'll be handling tonight's festivities. And together, we celebrate the power of story by setting the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through enchanted worlds found in fables and through windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of the human heart. Tonight, it's the charming world of our furry friends that get attention because they deserve it, and the theme will be a prelude to a terrific event performed by storytellers by the Houston Storytellers Guild. This weekend, the Guild is going to bring you animal stories for children of all ages at Company on Stage. And it's dubbed Children of All Ages for good reason. Because when it comes to animals, everyone's a kid. And tonight, my guests are guaranteed to make that very point. Sally Bates Goodrow is a collections development librarian at the Houston Public Library, where she orders books for kids and teens. She's been telling stories professionally since 1986, and especially folk tales and participation stories. Sally's on the board of the Guild, a repeat guest on this program, and a person I'm proud to call a friend. Eric Heen has been here before, and when you listen to him, you're going to know why he's here again. He's married, has two grown children, was born and raised in Montana, and has lived in Houston since 1995. He's a former sheep rancher, military policeman, animal control officer, and federal investigator. He quit the rat race to pursue a career in writing and is contributing writer for Mensa magazine. In 2011, Eric was named FanStory.com Short Works Writer of the Year. He's competed in four Moth Story Slam competitions and won two of them, the most recent being last night. And he is unquestionably one of my favorite storytellers and another person I'm proud to call a friend. Both Eric and Sally are members of the Guild, and Sally's one of the tellers performing this weekend. Each of these are quintessential storytellers who have their own signature styles. Sally's peaceful yet pronounced commitment to guiding listeners to a story's destination, and Eric's whimsical take on anything that moves. Now, I want to apologize in advance, everybody out there. I'm one of the millions of people in town who have been overcoming this upper respiratory, so my throat is terrible, and my voice will be worse than it is even when my voice is normal, right? How are you guys doing?
Good, good.
Happy New Year to you both.
Thank you.
Sally, tell us more about the role of Collectives Development Librarian. I'm fascinated because anything that requires teens and kids to read has got my attention.
Well, what I do is I select the books that we buy and also other materials like audiobooks and kits and ebooks. And sometimes I get to weigh in on some of the databases that we provide for kids and teens at the library.
It's a loaded question, Sally, but are kids reading as much as they used to?
That's I think kids question. Are reading in different ways. I feel like a lot of what they read is online now, and that's fine.
Is it?
Just a different kind of reading.
Right, right. You had a comment, Eric. You think people are reading as much?
They're different, like she said.
Yeah,
they're
right.
In a different way.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's a loaded question. We have a lot of opinions about that, and one day we're going to talk about them. Congratulations, Eric.
Thanks.
Last night, I thought, was evidence of your humor and timing, what I was talking about earlier. You, too, could be a photographer. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But it was a great story. It was a great story. Last night's theme was ambition, and it was a pretty magnificent narrative that Eric put together. He began by saying, I've always wanted to be a photographer. So I got into this correspondence class designed for what was the name of it? You too can be a photographer.
Right.
It was so simple and engaging. I want to say that because I'm not really doing it justice, but storytelling is all about how do you capture your audience. And I think that actually both of you do a fabulous job at capturing your audience immediately and not letting them go. But last night, Eric went 10th. People who go 10th usually don't win. I don't know if it's because the judges are drunk. I don't know what the reason is, but historically, you know, because Dusty goes through this announcement and, you know, they get your mind off of things. It's almost as if it's over. But, there's a 10th teller. But, you know, you nailed it, and you deserved it. It was terrific, just terrific.
Thanks so much.
Eric, you know, given tonight's theme, tell us what it was like to be an animal control officer. Because that's, I don't know what that is.
It was both rewarding and heartbreaking because, well, we did a lot of good, but I'd see a lot of sad situations,
yeah,
too, and had to take animals down to meet, yeah, their maker, if you know what I mean. So
yeah,
it was both rewarding and heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah, it is. You've got kids, and I know they're older, right?
They're in the
Do they have comments about you as a storyteller?
Well, they're very supportive, mm-hmm, but they kind of roll their eyes when I get a little too goofy.
Oh, eye rolling behavior.
Yeah, but that helps.
Tatiana, eye rolling behavior is a very real nonverbal phenomena for your generation, isn't it?
Oh, what is that supposed to mean?
It doesn't mean anything. I just thought I'd ask, you know. Oh, no. Oh, great. Our engineer is mad at me. This will be a great show. She's in total control.
Apologize
total control.
Now.
So they're supportive, and that's great. Yeah. They're there. Have, yeah, they ever watched you tell a story at the Moth or any place?
Not live, but they've seen the videos.
Yeah. They've seen the videos. All right. Yeah. Okay, I gotcha. Eric, you know, you've been on here twice with me and Greg, and I urge all of you to go to the Houston Storytellers Guild site and listen to Eric's show from April 27th of 2017 and get ready to bust your gut laughing because you're a funny, funny, funny person. And Sally, let's shift gears and talk about folktales, your genre. You love folktales. You've told me that they speak to you, and I know that it's a tough question, but tell us what it means when a story speaks to you.
I think it has to do with relating to the story, just like any good story. Folktales have been around because they survive because they do speak to people.
Yeah.
And there are so many different ones that anybody can relate to.
Yeah, and you're going to share some tonight that,
yes,
fit that bill. Absolutely. We are going to offer some thoughts about the importance of animals in folktales because they are so incredibly important. They personify the human condition. But you seem to like cats, right? Is that
I'm
right?
Not exactly sure why I know so many cat stories. I do own
you
cats,
do? Okay.
But I
All
also
right.
own dogs,
cats,
ferrets,
I got to tell you, I think about a cat, I'm wheezing. You know, I wheeze when I think about a cat. But they're the main character of tonight's stories. And I think you answer the question, why cats? You're not really sure. But you're going to start us off with two short stories about cats. Now, do they have a connection?
They do.
Okay.
And I can talk about it in between.
Great. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's enjoy them.
Okay. Well, this first story is an old fable. So there once was a young man who fell in love with his cat. And because it was a different time and a different place, he was able to find a magician to whom he would give a lot of money to turn his cat into a young woman so that he might marry her. He found the magician and installed the fellow in his house, and the room was inhabited by the magician, and there were strange noises and strange smells coming out of it for days at a time. And after some time had passed, the door opened, and there she was. Now the cat had beautiful, long, silky fur. The young woman had long, silky hair. The cat had deep golden eyes. The cat had deep golden eyes, and the woman had deep golden eyes as well. And the cat had moved with such grace, and now the woman moved with such grace that you could watch her for hours. Well, the young man wasted no time, and he was determined to marry her right away. And so he invited all of his friends to the wedding. Well, they all came, and the two of them were married. And after the wedding, everyone went into the hall for the feast. everybody could not stop talking about this young woman. She was so lovely. Where had she come from? She was so exotic. Was she from another country? Was she royalty? Nobody knew for sure. But then all at once, all the talking stopped because the young woman had leapt up on the table. And she had her front, her two hands on the table and her back feet on the table. And her eyes were fixed on something in the corner. They all turned and looked at what she was looking at, and it was a tiny gray mouse. And as they watched in horror, she leapt off the table, caught the mouse in her teeth, shook it until it was dead, and swallowed it. And so it is said in that place and that time ever since, that though you may change the shape of a thing, you are unable to change its nature. So that's a story. I think it's just a really old story, and I'm not even sure where it's exactly from. But I found the same story told in many different ways. And I think that's one cool thing about folktales, is that even though they change their shape, they don't change their nature. And you can find the same story told in different ways, in different places, for different purposes.
Right. So yeah, you can change them and still maintain the integrity. You can change the story but still keep the integrity.
Right, right. Yeah. So this next story is actually told today. And you might recognize it. There was once an old woman who had a cat, an old tomcat that she loved very, very much. One day, she happened to do a favor for someone, and that someone turned out to be a fairy. And that fairy said to her, "I'm going to give you 3 wishes." Well, the old woman didn't have to think very hard for her first wish. She said, "I wish that I was young and beautiful." And poof, she was young and she was beautiful. For her second wish, she said, "I wish that I was rich." And poof, she was rich. And the fairy said, "Now for your third wish, what do you want for your third wish?" And she had to think for a little while, and then she looked over at her old tomcat, who had been such a faithful companion, and she said, "I know what I want for my third wish. I wish that my tomcat was a young and handsome man." And poof, her old tomcat was a young and handsome man. But the first words that her cat said to her were, "Now aren't you sorry you had me fixed?"
Very good. You know, sometimes the best stories end in a joke, right? In a joke. Very, we don't know where that one comes from.
Well, I've just heard it around a lot. There's actually a folk song, which is the same story.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
you know, just an old, yeah, folk tale made,
right,
into a joke.
Tatiana, did you find that to be funny? She has a strange sense of humor. Did you find that to be funny?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know what you mean by strange sense of humor.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you this one, okay? Let me ask you this one, see if you know the answer. What did the duck say after she bought some lipstick?
You have me there. What did she
put
say?
It on my bill. Okay. This is... Yeah, okay. All right. It's a moaner. All right. It follows the cat story, I thought, really well. This is Hank Rubicek with Tatiana Gago on the boards, and we are talking to the animals, or at least talking about them, with guest storytellers Sally Bates Goodrow and Eric Heen on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Both of you guys love Dr. Doolittle? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Dr. Doolittle. Yeah, as much as I do, I love him. And for listeners who just came out of their comas and never heard of the name Dr. Doolittle, he's the central character in a series of children's books by Hugh Lofting. And like Eddie Murphy, who portrayed the good doctor in the film, Dr. Doolittle shuns human patients in favor of animals, with whom he can speak in their languages. And vets know a lot better. They start with animals. Now, Eric, I actually envision you as a Dr. Doolittle type, and I mean that in obviously the most complimentary sense of the word.
Thanks.
You've worked with animals, and there are probably more animals than people in Montana. I'm
Definitely.
Just guessing, right? There you go. So I'll bet that you can answer this question or take a stab at it. What makes animals so inviting? Because they are.
Hmm.
Right?
Well, I'd say their innocence. I mean, I kind of envy them for their innocence, because They just live their lives mm-hmm. and don't talk about politics or how to make money.
Yeah.
So, in a nutshell, they're innocents.
They really are. And they're consistent. And they're honest, right? And they're trusting. Mm-hmm. And when people ask me, well, how do you know if a dog or cat is trusting, I think it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, trust is an expectancy that somehow the message can be relied upon. They're a series of routines, right? Mm-hmm. And the old notion that you never trust anybody that your dog doesn't like, I think is so incredibly true. Now, there are lots of things that make you an exceptional storyteller, Eric, and I know the two of those really are that instinctive sense of humor and timing, something I referred to a little bit earlier. And the Murph is your first story, right?
Yes.
The Murph. Now, this is your character, your story. What I'm leading up to is that you've got to take ownership for this one, my friend.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us, why don't you tell everyone the primary feature of a Murph?
Well, I would say Murph is the dog. It's a dog in the story. I'd say Murph was just one big living, breathing abnormality.
Uh-huh.
But he sort of flaunted his abnormality. He just kind of relished it. So.
Uh-huh.
Is
yeah.
a abnormality.
Okay, abnormality. And you made reference to mooning or something at one point, wasn't
I
that?
Did.
Didn't you?
Mooning in Montana?
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, no.
Don't make fun of my hobbies.
It sort of cracked me up when you said that. Yeah, cracked me up.
Crowd,
yes. You know, at cracked. The crack of dawn. Yes,
crack,
okay.
Got it.
I just thought you might like that. Okay. Let's hear the Murph.
The Murph, yes, sir. Well, 20 years ago, I was a self-employed plumber, and sometimes I had to deal with customers who failed to pay their bills. But instead of turning them over to collection agencies, I dabbled in the barter system. I'd get things like tools, furniture, car parts. I even once repaired a faucet for a rhubarb pie. But my most meaningful bartering acquisition was a dog named Murph. It was when I installed a toilet for an old man, and I handed him the bill. He shuffled his feet and he said, can I make payments? Well, I never messed with payments, so I said, got anything to barter? His eyes lit up and he dragged me to his backyard, showed me a bunch of junk back there, but I saw nothing I wanted. Then he grabbed me by the arm and he said, what about the dog? I looked around and said, what dog? He walked over to some bizarre looking creature and started leading it toward me and he said, his name's Murph. Well, I hadn't seen this Murph thing because it blended in so compatibly with the surrounding junk. This dog looked like it had been assembled from several different animal parts. It took me a moment to locate its head. The dog was pretty big, but his legs were so short, and his fur was so long and shaggy that you couldn't see his legs. So when he walked toward me, he seemed to be sort of floating over the ground. It was a very wobbly way. Creepiest of all, his eyes weren't in sync. They moved independently of each other. Essentially, Murph looked like a dog even Mother Teresa might kick. Well, this creature was the last thing I needed, but the old man kept wringing his hands and looking at me, so I finally said, okay, I'll take your mangy mutt. Well, on the way home, the more I looked at this oddball creature lying next to me, the more I realized I had made a mistake. So I drove up to the dog pound. I hauled Murph out of the truck. I was leading him toward the building. But then he stopped in his tracks and he started sniffing the air. I looked up and I saw smoke billowing from the incinerator chimney. Yeah, Murph looked over at me with those droopy eyes as if he knew what was going on. I said, oh, what the hell? I took him back to my truck and I cursed myself for my weakness and I drove home with Murph. First, I was kind of ashamed of Murph. I didn't really want to be seen with him. I remember the first time my annoying neighbor, Henry, walked to the fence and saw Murph. He said, dang, that thing looks like a mistake of nature. And to be honest, I couldn't argue with that. He said, I seen a platypus once, and this mutt looks even weirder than a platypus. He said, but he must be a damn big dog when he stands up. I said, Henry, he is standing up. Henry said, where'd you get him? I said, I traded the toilet for him. Henry said, must have been a pretty ugly toilet. Then he starts laughing and he walks away. I kind of wish Murph would have just jumped up and bit him, but that wasn't Murph's style. Whenever anyone saw Murph. I heard a lot of jokes about him, and I laughed along at first, but the more crap people gave Murph, the more I found myself sticking up for him. Well, I went to the park one Sunday morning, and I tried to teach Murph a few tricks, but it was hopeless. I tried to teach him how to sit, but he was anatomically unable to do so. He was so top-heavy that he'd just tumble face-first to the ground. I tried to teach him to shake hands, but he'd just lick my fingers. I tried to teach him to fetch, but when I throw the ball, he'd just look at me as if to say, "What's the point in this?" Well, I let him loose there in the dog park so he could socialize with the other dogs, but they all rejected him. But this didn't faze Murph. He waddled around alone, sniffing and licking the trees and the rocks. He even licked the dirt. But you know, that day, I looked around that park at all the fancy purebreds and the athletic dogs running and catching frisbees. I started to think I probably wouldn't have traded Murph for any of them. It got to be that every evening after I'd come home from work, Murph and I went through this bizarre ritual. Murph would trudge up to meet me at the door, carrying an old baseball glove in his mouth. He'd formed this weird attachment to that glove. He carried it everywhere. Then I'd pat him on the head and go to my easy chair to read my books. Murph would follow me to the chair, drop the glove to the floor. Then he'd plop down and spend the rest of the evening wallowing there at my feet and making funny noises. I hadn't realized it yet, but Murph had become a big part of my life. Well, one evening, I came home from work, and instead of meeting me for our ritual, Murph lay in the middle of the floor. Well, with him being Murph, I just figured he was in an extra deep sleep that day. So I flopped in my chair to read my books. But when Murph would sleep, he'd always do a lot of grunting and wiggling around. After a few minutes, I realized Murph hadn't moved at all. I reached down, I lifted his head up, I jiggled him from side to side for a while. Well, after he failed to respond, I lowered him back to the floor, tucked his baseball glove under his head. I looked at Murph there with all his defects. A dog nobody wanted. A dog traded for a toilet. But he still looked so gratified, as if he'd had a good life with no shame or regrets. His eyes remained open just a slit, as if he wanted to tell me one last thing. Well, while I looked at him, I pondered my own defects. I was a college dropout. I was divorced, lousy social skills. But unlike Murph, I'd always cursed the world for my flaws. Well, I reached down to press his eyes shut. I knew what he was telling me. If Murph was good enough for Murph, then God dang it, I'm good enough for me.
Thanks. Very good. All right. Now, seriously, you wrote that, right?
Yes,
you
yes,
wrote
sir.
That.
Yes.
And this is, we have to talk about this for a moment. I mean, Sally, you're a folklorist, and you know how difficult it is to tell a folktale, let alone write one. What's your impressions of that? Because I know you heard it for the first time.
It was wonderful. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah. There's some really wonderful things in there. And what I find fascinating, and I don't know if you do this intentionally, but it doesn't make any difference because it worked, is that, you know, the characters in a folktale really do personify the human experience, mm-hmm. right? They do that. So tell us, you know, Murph was a metaphor for what? Or he personified what?
I would say just being yourself. Self-acceptance.
Right.
That's
right.
What I say.
Self-acceptance. Right.
Absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that. Self-acceptance. Where did I get the mooning over Montana thing? Did you tell me that in notes?
I think.
Or am I just making that up?
You started it, Dr. Hank.
I started it?
I
well,
so.
Pretty funny.
Let's just say that's none of us, okay?
Thank you. That was Tatiana laughing. And that was really good. Thank you, Tatiana. Did you hear that? Was that over? Okay, very good. Excellent. Now, Tatiana, all of us, sorry about the Montana mooning joke. I have no idea where I heard that. Maybe I was dreaming. I don't know. But in any event, Tatiana, tell us about our astonishing storytelling community, because there are no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Oh, boy. I'm not surprised that you said that, but I can't believe that you said that. However, what I really can't believe is why anyone wouldn't want to learn about the art of telling by going to the monthly story swaps held by our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Go to their website, www.HoustonStorytellers.org, for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program.
Thank you, Tatiana. You know, I also want to remind our listeners about the great event to which I earlier referred. If you want more of what you're listening to tonight, and why wouldn't you, a few members from the Guild will be mesmerizing you with stories about animals, the kind that taps the child in all of us. This weekend, January 12th and 13th from 7 to 8:45 at Company on Stage, which is held at Salem Lutheran Church. Go to the Guild site for all the details. Now, we're not allowed to talk about price on Pacifica Radio, but the price of this weekend's concert is on the Houston Storyteller Guild site. It's cheap. I can tell you this much. The amount of a ticket has one syllable. How's that? Is that good? Right? No, okay, nobody got that one. I just thought, okay. Tatiana, what else do we want our listeners to know other than wanting me to shut up? Go ahead.
Well, here's something.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Not having a radio is no excuse for missing our show, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. Tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with your friends. And we'd love it if you'd like us on the way out.
Thank you so much. Great information, Tatiana. Thank you. This means anyone on the planet can enjoy the world of storytelling as only you can on So What's Your Story. And we're not alone. One of the best storytelling groups in Houston is our good friends at The Moth, that meets typically the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. I mentioned earlier, Eric really did kill it last night with his photography story. He wanted to take pics of the King of Norway at his sister's college graduation. Is that a good synopsis?
That's pretty good.
Now, did she go to St. Olaf?
No, she went to Hillcrest.
Because you mentioned Olaf. King Olaf?
That was the name of the king.
Okay, fine. You look at me like I'm the only one who probably heard that. You ought to be impressed, actually. You know, people were really thinking, who is he? They were not thinking. Most of the people there were millennials, and they were wondering if Norway was near Maine. So you have to understand something. It was a thoughtful thing. Right. Am I insulting you, Tatiana? Okay. Just giving you a hard time. You know, geography, if you don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going. You've heard that one, haven't you?
No, but I passed geography, I'll tell you that.
That's all I know. You passed my class too, but you know that. What does that mean? Okay. In the meantime, excellent. Listen, I'm going to be here next week with a very special program that will showcase a Houston family dedicated to world peace. Now, we hear a lot about that, but there's no hyperbole here. Dr. Mehdi Alavi and his daughter Sarah, who's a brilliant singer, who's been a guest on this program before, and her sister Lisa, an astonishing artist in her own right, are going to tell stories that prove their commitment, and this is no hyperbole, to world peace. No kidding. And their website talks about all they've done for people of the world. I know that sounds enticing, and I hope it is, because they're going to be here next week, and we're going to be talking about it. You know, one of my favorite stories, and I just want to read it real carefully. I can tell it, but I want to make sure that I get this accurate, is a story about animals. And Sally, I'm sure you know it, and Eric, you might too. It's really a synopsis of a story, an old folk tale about animals and a farmer. But it's not just about animals. It also, I think, tells us why we love storytelling so much. It's about a farmer who had so many beautiful crops, he'd set traps for all the animals whom he feared would destroy them. Now, the birds and the squirrels and raccoons never came. The farmer thought himself successful until one day he realized how terribly lonely he was. So he walked out to the middle of his field and held out his arms to welcome the animals. No one creature came, for they all feared the farmer's new scarecrow. And I love that story. I love that story because it's not just about animals, but you had mentioned earlier about the innocence of animals. Mm-hmm. And I want to delve into that for a moment, because some of my favorite folk tales, and I don't tell folk tales nearly as well as Sally, and not as well as you. I you know, folk tales is not my thing in terms of telling. But I sometimes use them when I can't explain something through a personal narrative. And if you give me just a moment, I want to demonstrate that point because I think it's important. And stories like this reminded me of that. You know, there's one of my favorite stories is called The Cricket by a folklorist called Joel Ben Izzy. And Joel Ben Izzy had throat cancer for many years, and he's still alive and well. And he prayed to God that he says, you know, I have throat cancer, and with this ailment, I can't tell stories. What am I going to do? So he wrote stories, and what he did was to take stories from other cultures and sort of blend them and fuse them into his own understanding of what those cultures were and created his own set of stories. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, once he did that, he felt great about bringing the world closer together. And magically, and it is magically, his voice came back. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a religious person, but there has to be something about making an attempt at orchestrating peace among people in the world and suddenly getting your voice back. Mm-hmm. And I love that story. And one story is The Cricket, and a story that he tells far better than I ever will. But it's a cricket that I think about when I think about my grandfather. My grandfather wanted to play the piano, and he never could. So when he used to play with the, you know, the keys, it sounded awful, and we all said, please put it away. And you know, he kept at it. My grandmother also liked to play the piano, and she wasn't that great. And it was a family who wanted to be musically inclined, and they really weren't. So I think to myself, you know, the cricket wanted to go to the moon. And he jumped high enough where he made it to the top of a tree. And the crickets would all laugh at him, saying, oh, he's trying to get to the moon. But one day he decided to stay at the top of the tree so they didn't see him come back down. And one of the mothers of one of the little cricket children of the neighborhood said, you know, maybe he made it to the moon. Because he kept trying. He just kept trying. Now, that's a quick story, and it's probably meaningless to the entire world. To me, I think about it when I think about my family, because they always tried. They always tried something, and they never gave up. And we know that, how important that is, but it's these folk tales that I think ignite an idea about our lives that sometimes a personal narrative can't necessarily convey. In any event, I just wanted to share that. Animals, you know, tonight is really upbeat, and I like that because we've done programs about animals in the past. We've told stories about losing pets, each story requiring a really large box of Kleenex. Oh, Tatiana. I'm sorry, Tatiana.
No, you're not.
I should have held that back until Tatiana was. She's very sensitive, especially when Greg and I, you know, who are the two kings of creating depression, when we talk about our pets behind the mic. But the animal concert this weekend, I wanted everybody to know, is not going to be a cluster of sad stories, right?
No, not at all.
Just want everybody to know that. Animals are inviting and fun and engaging and a lot more essential than anybody thinks, particularly in fables. Right, Sally?
Yes, I agree with you.
Tell us a little bit why.
Oh, well, I think that a lot of times you can believe that an animal will do something and learn from that better than you can if you're actually watching a person, because people are so much more complicated, just like we've been saying.
I think that's so true. Absolutely. Like the Murph.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
He's not complicated. He's just a regular character that we love and understand.
Mm-hmm.
He simplifies things. Mm-hmm. He's not profound. Right? Or is he? Would you say he's profound?
He's never kind of mind.
I'm sorry. Eric is saying, please. Oh, my God, this is confusing me. Stories, you know, mostly fables, use animals to personify the human experience because I think they add emotional distance for the reader when the story is powerful or painful, right? Sally, your next story is a short version of an Italian folktale that you're going to be telling this weekend. And again, it showcases a cat and is entitled Kingdom of Cats.
Yes.
Let's hear it.
Well, once upon a time, there was a young woman, and her name was Maria. Now, Maria lived with her stepmother and stepsister in a town in Italy, and her stepmother treated her terribly. She had to do all the work of the house. She had to work from early in the morning until after dark. But even though she worked so hard every day, she got more and more beautiful until finally her stepmother said to herself, my daughter is never going to have anyone want to marry her with this girl around. I must get rid of her. So the very next day, she gave Maria a big basket of dirty clothes, and she said, I want you to take this basket to the river. Here's a tiny bit of soap. Take this, and you must wash everything until it is spotless. And if you do not clean everything completely, to my satisfaction, you may not come home. Well, what could Maria do? She took the basket of clothes to the river, and she got down on her knees, and she picked out one of the blouses that belonged to her stepsister, Elena. She took the little bit of soap, and she started to scrub. But just then, a wave from the river took the soap out of her hand, and she lost the soap. Well, then she started to cry, because she knew she couldn't go home. She couldn't clean the clothes without the soap. Well, just then an old woman came by and said, my granddaughter, why are you crying? And she said, oh, I've lost my soap in the water. I can't go home until everything is clean and the soap is lost. The old woman said, do not worry, my child, for underneath the river is the kingdom of the cats. Only walk down into the water and find your way to the castle where the queen of the cats lives. And if you ask her very politely, I'm sure she will give you back your soap. Well, Maria wasn't sure about this, but she thanked the old woman, gathered her skirts around her, and stepped into the water, deeper and deeper, until the water closed over her head. But she found that she could breathe, and there was an entire world at the bottom of the river, and in front of her, a castle all made of glass. Well, she walked carefully up the glass steps and opened the glass door, and inside the castle was full of cats, of all sizes, all colors. Young cats, old cats, and they were all working. They were all sweeping and making beds and cooking. And because she was a kind girl, she stopped and helped them. She helped one cat sweep. She helped two other cats make a bed. She helped in the kitchen by cutting up some fish. And then all at once there was the sound of a bell, and a voice said, those who have worked may eat. Those who have not worked may not eat. Well, she followed all the cats, who went into a big dining room. And there was the queen of the cats with a silver crown and a silver bell. And she said, who are you? And have you worked today? And Maria said, my name is Maria, and I came because I lost my soap. And the other cats that she had helped, they said, oh, yes, she helped us. She did work today. Ah, well, then, said the queen, come and eat with us. And Maria sat down, and she ate from a golden plate and drank from a golden goblet. And at the end of the meal, the queen took her into another room where there was all different kinds of dresses, beautiful gowns, and slippers and shoes on the floor, and jewelry in drawers. And all of the cats took her rags and gave her a lovely new gown and put a necklace around her neck and combs in her hair and gave her slippers to wear. And then the queen of the cats gave her a big cake of soap and said, now you must leave us. But as you walk up the riverbank, remember that you will hear two sounds. When you hear a rooster crow, make sure your eyes are open. And when you hear the donkey bray, make sure your eyes are closed. Well, Maria thanked all the cats and said goodbye, carefully walked down the glass steps and started to walk up the riverbank. And all at once she heard the donkey bray, so she closed her eyes. And then she heard the rooster crow and she opened them again. And she felt something land in the middle of her forehead. Well, it so happened that the prince of that country was riding his horse along the river that day when he saw a basket of clothes left all by itself, and he worried that maybe the person to whom they belonged had fallen in the water. Well, he heard a splash and turned around, and there was the most lovely young woman he had ever seen coming out of the water, and in the middle of her forehead was a golden star, as if to say there is a kind and loving soul within. Well, he immediately took her hand, and after talking with her a while, asked if she might come with him to the palace to meet his mother and father. He thought she would make a very good princess. Well, she agreed, but she said she must stop by her house to tell her stepmother where she was going. And so they went to her house, and she left off the basket and told them exactly what had happened to her. And then she was gone. Well, I can tell you her stepmother was not very pleased that Maria had gotten such a wonderful thing to happen to her, and she immediately ran upstairs to where her own daughter Elena was still in bed, and she said, "Elena, tomorrow you are taking that basket to the river, you are losing your soap in the water, you are going to the kingdom of the cats, and you are going to marry a prince." Well, Elena wasn't really wild about it. She didn't like to work at all, but her mother said, "You don't have to work, you just have to do what your stepsister did." So she went the next day, plopped the basket by the river, threw the soap in the water, pretended to cry, listened to when the old woman said what to do, and did exactly what the old woman told her, which was to walk into the water and walk to the glass castle. And when she got there, did she help any cats? Oh, no. Oh, no. First of all, she didn't even know how to hold a broom. She just laughed. She said, "I have never seen anything so silly as cats trying to do housework." Well, sure enough, the bell sounded through the castle. All the cats went into the dining room. The queen of the cats asked, "Who has work today?" Well, Elena hadn't done anything. They managed to find a crust of bread and some water for her. And after they had eaten, they took her into the room with all the gowns. But they dressed her in Maria's old rags and gave her Maria's little sliver of soap. But as she was about to leave, the queen of the cats said, "Remember, as you walk up the riverbank, you will hear two sounds. You will hear a donkey bray and you will hear a rooster crow. Make sure that your eyes are closed when the donkey brays and that your eyes are open when the rooster crows." Well, Elena didn't even say thank you. What was there to say thank you for anyway, even if she had wanted to? So she stomped her way down the glass steps, leaving cracks in every single one. She was so angry that she didn't even notice that the donkey was braying until it was so late that when she closed her eyes, there was the rooster crowing, and she felt something land in the middle of her forehead. Well, if there had been a prince riding along the river that day, he would have seen a very disgruntled young woman sloshing her way out of the water, and he would have seen that something was growing out of her head. It was a donkey's tail. Well, when Elena opened her eyes and saw that hairy thing in front of them, she screamed. She ran all the way home, and her mother nearly fainted. They tried twisting it off. They tried cutting it off. They tried pulling it off, but it was growing from the middle of her forehead. And so finally, Elena begged and begged until her mother moved with her into the middle of the woods where no one would see that horrible donkey tail. But as for Maria, she and her prince were married and lived happily ever after.
All right. Now, a donkey's tail. talk about a need for waxing. Now, the notion is... Now, we're not going to tell everybody, you know, the rest of the story, because obviously you did a version of this. How do you make a decision about how to edit a story and keep it intact? Does that make sense? Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, you kind of have to figure out what are the most important parts of it. You have to figure what the story is about, which can be different for every teller, mm-hmm. and what you want to get across.
And what, you know, you've told stories for many years, Sally. Who's your primary target audience when you tell folk tales?
Well, a folk tale can be told to any age. I would say starting at about 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And you just have to tailor the story to the age of the kids. I mean, you could actually tell that story to a 4 or 5 year old if you edited it in a certain way. That's the thing about folk tales, is they go for all ages.
And that's a story you're going to be telling this weekend. Right?
It is.
And you're also going to be telling. Are you going to be telling any participation stories this
weekend? I am.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in just a moment. I just wanted to spend just a moment offering you a tip for the teller. This is a popular segment because this is a time when we offer a way to darn your yarn. You know, in the movie Walk the Line, Johnny Cash is looking for work. He's unsuccessful until his soon-to-be producer asks, "If you had to sing one song, Mr. Cash, what would it be? That one song that you'd sing while dying in the gutter, that song that defined you." It's dramatic but true, and certainly when thinking about personal stories. You know, sometimes, especially in places like the Moffitt, Eric, I think you'll know what I mean, you see folks who seem to have a story, but they're kind of practicing, you know? They're not really comfortable with it, not as comfortable as they'd like to be.
Right.
And they're not really telling their stories. And there's nothing wrong with practicing, because practicing is necessary. But, you know, there's a great storyteller incarnate, the late Sid Lieberman, died 2 years ago, who believed that when you tell a story, you give the impression that the story must be told. You tell listeners it's urgent to listen. Your eyes say things like, don't get up. Don't leave until I give you permission to do so. Your need to tell the story is more powerful than the apprehension you may feel about delivering it. So you got to be patient. Practice your story, but make sure you're ready to tell it. Sound good? Yes? Make sense?
Yes.
Sounds really good.
Oh, yes.
Now, in your next story, you've got a story here. Again, it's yours. And by the way, you have an incredibly different tone when you tell these stories versus personal ones. I have to ask you this quick question. When you compose these, do you think about telling them in oral form, or are they designed to be written when you first compose these?
Well, when I wrote these, I'd never been come close to a stage. It was long before I started
all right.
doing that.
That's interesting. Good to know. Well, you need to take these to the stage, but it's a different tone that you offer. Very intriguing. This one is called The Bastard Lamb.
Yes.
How was this one crafted? Just one night drinking beer? Or
well, it came out pretty easily, because lambing time on a sheep ranch, it's so hectic that the atmosphere just kind of permeates your own soul. And so I just kind of opened up my soul a little bit. The words fell out. This is what happened.
Got it.
Right?
Yep.
Well, while I was in the Army overseas, my father retired from the banking business, and just out of the blue, he buys a sheep ranch in Montana. He'd grown up on a farm, so I guess he wanted to get back to his roots. But about the time I got out of the service, my dad had a crippling stroke, and he ended up totally disabled. There's no way he could run the farm after that. Well, at the time, I was unemployed and kind of shiftless, and even though I knew nothing about ranching, let alone sheep, I offered to go out there and try at least to keep the operation going until he could sell the place. Well, my dad didn't have a lot of faith in me, but he finally gave in, and I headed over there and tried around the ranch. Got there just a couple weeks before lambing time. Now, lambing time's when everything goes crazy, and for about 2 months, you're basically working 24 hours a day. So I got a book called The Complete Guide to Raising Sheep, and I read it cover to cover at least 3 times. I totally memorized the procedures. I figured, what could go wrong if you go strictly by the book? Well, when the due dates for the first lambs came, I was constantly driving through the sheep field, ready to pounce on any ewe that went into labor. But nothing happened that whole first day. The sheep just stared at me like I was some kind of intruder. Well, nighttime came, and I set my alarm clock to get up every 2 hours to check on the flock. But nothing happened all night. 2 more days of this, and still nothing. The first lamb hadn't dropped, and I was already getting worn out. On the third night, it happened. At 3 in the morning, I was driving through the field, and in my headlights, I saw you squirming on her side and kicking her legs out, just like the pictures in the book showed. I jumped out of my truck, scrambled over to her, and saw that her lamb's nose and front hooves were just beginning to emerge. I ran back to my truck, grabbed my utility box of supplies, and I scrambled back to the ewe. As I approach her, I hear an oozing sound, and suddenly there was this little slimy lamb squirming on the ground. The ewe had had the audacity to bear her lamb without my expert intervention. Well, I took a deep breath, and I went through the steps that I'd so thoroughly memorized. First step was to ensure all tissue is removed from the lamb's face to allow adequate breathing. Well, I grabbed a rag from the box, but the ewe was already licking her lamb's face clean. But I didn't trust her, so I crouched down, and I rubbed that rag into her lamb's snout. Apparently, the ewe wasn't too pleased because she headbutted me in the legs the whole time. She didn't seem to appreciate who was the expert here. Then I went to step 2. You place your finger into the lamb's mouth to ensure the temperature is sufficiently warm. With one leg, I held off the ewe, and I crammed my fingers into the lamb's mouth. And I realized I didn't know how sufficiently warm was. But somehow I figured if I just performed the procedures in the book, everything would somehow turn out okay. For the third step, I felt to use udder to make sure there was no sign of mastitis. I was fumbling around with it, but once again, I wasn't sure what I was checking for. But the book said to do it, so I did it. The ungrateful ewe was whining louder and louder. She just didn't realize she was supposed to be a bystander here. I went to step four. Squeeze to use teats to ensure proper milk flow. I managed to do this. The ewe was not amused. She kept trying to kick me away. The next step was to get the pair into a lambing pen in the barn. I grabbed the lamb. I left my truck where it was, and I started slowly backing up toward the barn, holding the lamb out toward its mother. Now, I was to witness this same scene dozens of times in the following weeks, and it never ceased to amaze me. Because ordinarily, sheep are so flighty, you can't get within 50 feet of them. But when you're holding their lamb, they'd follow you to hell and back. Now, halfway to the barn, I noticed another ewe squirming on her side, kicking her legs. I knew the onslaught was about to begin, so I quickened my pace. I managed to get the pair back to the barn. I got them into a lambing pen and set up the heat lamp. Now, I knew I had to get back to the flock as soon as possible, but I felt inspired to somehow commemorate the momentous occasion of my first lamb. I snatched that lamb, and I symbolically held it high over my head. I proclaimed to the gods that be that I was a noble sheep rancher, a man of the land. And all this time, the lamb was crying out. I figured that in lamb language, he was saying, "Life, oh glorious life." Suddenly, I felt the plop of newborn lamb manure slithering between my open lips. I suddenly realized that instead of crying out, "Oh, glorious life," the lamb was saying, "Put me down, you moron." I gladly plopped the lamb back down to its mother, and I spit the manure from my mouth. The gods themselves could not have concocted a more fitting metaphor for my impending taste of reality.
I love it. And Tatiana, this is where the expression "ew" came from. Did you know that? Oh, yeah. Isn't that true? Now, you took the storytelling class, right, with me. Do you remember what folktale you told?
Oh, yes. I did my own version of Little Red Riding Hood.
Oh, yeah. What is it about that story that's obviously a classic? What was it about that story that you loved? I know you did a different version.
Yes.
But you can tell us. I know it's a little tricky, but go ahead. I know what it was.
Well, it was more modernized version, yeah. I would say. Mm-hmm. But that story, it's not only is it my favorite, but there are a lot of messages in that sort of hidden messages in there. And it's also very dark, but also very true.
And it is, because the original version was very dark. We'll just leave it at that.
Yes.
But, stories, when you think about the origins, wow. Pacifica Radio is what you're listening to, APFT 90.1 FM, with great tellers, Eric Keene and Sally Bates Goodrow. Sally, I know we don't have a lot of time, but give us a sample of a participation story.
Well, you guys know this one. Just anything that has repetition can become a participation story. Right. So I say, little pig, let me come in. What do you say?
Not by the hair of my chitty chin chin.
So I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. So, yeah, you just do that enough and kids know how to join.
Now, what if they don't know it at all?
You start out, and with the repetition, you encourage them to join in.
And you're going to be doing that this weekend.
I'm not going to be doing this story, but I am doing another participation story. Okay. And so is Sheila Phillips and a couple
other
people.
And let's talk about the obvious. These participation stories, as simple as they sound, promote interaction. And the kind of relationship that you can build through the kind of participative stories are really quite astounding. They are. And I'm not just saying that. There's a lot of research to reinforce this. Stories allow us to connect. We've said that so many times. It's a great way of plugging in without plugging anything in. It doesn't make any difference what kind of story we're talking about. Not at all. You guys have any shout-outs?
Oh, I don't know.
No friends?
I'll go with my lovely wife, Yelena.
Yeah.
Hi, Yelena.
She is great.
My lovely husband, David.
David.
Right? And my lovely daughter, David, Katie. Right? I don't think she's
Who was a storyteller in your house growing up?
I think my mom really was, yeah.
But what about you?
My late brother-in-law, Glenn, the best fishing stories you ever heard.
Fishing stories. He was a fisherman.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and a hunter, yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. You know, when we talk about, and this is always a time when I get frustrated because we're almost at the end, but, you know, there is so much that we learn, not only about stories, but obviously about all of you, about the people who come here. And it's an experience that I would never, ever substitute. I just wanted to thank you both for that. And we're going to be talking about that just a little bit now. But, you know, to celebrate tonight's sign-off, we are going to play an obvious tune for you, right? And you're going to just start in just a minute. And I'm going to go ahead and sign off. And you're going to enjoy this from the Tokens 1971, A Lion Sleeps Tonight. Uh-huh. It's obvious, but it's a classic. Sally Bates Goodrow and Eric Keane, you've both been here before. And obviously, you're going to be here again. In case you don't know it, you will. I want to thank you so much for your energy, your imagination, and for your joyful spirits. You are, in my judgment, portraits of storytelling excellence. You really are. Animal Stories, this Friday and Saturday, 7 to 8:30, company on stage. Be there or be incredibly square. Don't even think about moving, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are up next with very cool classics for the much cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. We're singing and dancing in here, aren't we? You keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the SWYS team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Near the village, the peaceful village, the lion sleeps tonight. Near the village, the quiet village, the lion sleeps tonight. Oh, we know it.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer Program,